T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
State Investor Radio Show, a real estate investment program. Listen and learn how to use real estate to build wealth and passive income streams for you and your family. We bring you experts every day to discuss and answer your questions on everything from single-family homes all the way up to 600-plus unit apartment complexes. And now, the Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show.
Welcome to the Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show. I'm your host, Del Walmsley, and as always, we're working on your financial freedom. With me here today to cover a variety of topics is Charles Ho. Charles came prepared today to discuss a topic on how to manage your staff in your apartment complexes and how to develop your team around you. And I'm going to interrupt that conversation first by going over something that people have been pounding me with all week long. They got me to succumb to the desire to cover some negative economic information that's come out for Dallas. And since Charles is from Dallas, I think that's the perfect person to discuss this information with. So I'm going to go ahead and cover it. And unlike what would be considered normal radio rules, I'm going to read some stuff right off of the page because I cannot articulate it any better than just straight right out of the material, because it's a lot of factual type statements. So I'm just going to go ahead and read it out to Charles here so that he can prepare himself to conversate on it. So it states, Dallas' once vibrant housing market is sputtering. In the high-end subdivisions in the suburb of Frisco, builders are cutting prices on new homes by up to $150,000 per home. On one street alone, $4 million of new homes sat empty on a visit earlier this month. Some home builders are so desperate to attract interest, they're offering agents the chance to win Louis Vuitton handbags and Super Bowl tickets with round-trip airfare if their clients buy a home. Yet fresh-baked cookies sit uneaten, sparingly attending these open houses. The U.S. economy just had one of its best six-month stretches in a decade, as unemployment rates hovered around its lowest level in half a century. Still, along with recent swoons in stock market, the housing market, which makes up one-sixth of the U.S. economy, has been troubling weak spot. U.S. existing home sales have declined on an annual basis for 8 straight months, the longest slump in more than 4 years, according to the National Association of Realtors report Wednesday. The slowdown has driven by places that have earlier seen some of the strongest price growth during the recovery, including Seattle, Denver, New York, Boston, and Bay Area. Dallas, which had the second strongest annual increase in employment of any metro area in the country, is one of these areas that's having the hardest turnaround. Even though the economy in the sprawling metro area has boomed, home prices has grown much faster than wages buyers have been sustaining to afford homes. Those price challenges have been masked in part by access to cheap credit. But the era is coming to an end. Since the beginning of the year, mortgage rates have risen about a percentage point to the highest level since 2011. We have this huge affordability crisis, says Ted Wilson, principal of Residential Strategies, Dallas consulting firm. With mortgage rates going higher, we're hitting a ceiling. New and existing home sales in Dallas-Fort Worth metropolitan area fell 3.6% in October compared with a year earlier. According to the Real Estate Center for Texas A&M University, while the median home price growth slowed to less than half of the pace a year ago, Dallas has been the canary in the mine shaft, according to Paige Shipp, regional director of some metro study, a consultant in home builders. Homes are taking longer to sell. Bidding wars are rare and price cuts are more common as buyers absorb the impact of the higher rates. Dallas is one of the markets where affordability has gotten further out of whack with historic norms. The metro area avoided the last housing boom, with home values from 97 through 2006 rising a moderate 2.5% a year on average, according to Zillow, where other places they rose as much as 26% as a whole. So, Charles, here we sit. Let's see what we can make out of some of this stuff. First of all, we'll talk about the fact that there is this lowering of the number of new homes sold, especially on these mansions, these big expensive houses. That particularly doesn't affect me at all. It doesn't bother me at all in the macro sense. In fact, when they said there's no bidding wars, I actually think that's probably a good thing. In other words, it's been a seller's market so strongly that now, you know, they put something on the market, somebody's got to buy it. Before, people were bidding the prices up, paying more than what the list price was, which I think is a ridiculous position to be in. So I'm not really worried by that aspect of it, that it's no longer a seller's market. I'm not worried about it as an apartment owner because of the fact that if people aren't buying these homes and if they can't build affordable housing, which is the next segment of this article, which I didn't even cover in the last segment, which is that they can't build affordable housing anymore, that those people don't have any place to live except our apartments. All of this doesn't seem to scare me too much other than, and I brought this up last segment, that maybe it's a trigger, maybe it's a point. You know, everything on a pendulum, if a pendulum swings back and forth, the pendulum has to peak before it can come back down. Maybe we peaked. How you see this? Charles Ho, liver and master of the Dallas market. How do you see all this?
Hey, great to be here with you, Dale. Actually, I want to go back to what you said in the first, I think it was two, three sentences, and it's just drew on that just a little bit. I think it's that one street had $4 million in new homes empty on a visit. Okay, so picture this in your mind. $4 million worth of new homes, okay? How many houses do you actually see? Okay, and then I'm going to go back to about one another sentence before that. The builders are cutting prices by $150,000 each. Okay, how expensive does a house have to be able to cut $150,000?
Are you telling me these houses cost $1 million a piece, Charles? Are you alluding to the fact that this is four houses maybe on that street that cost $1 million each? Is that what you're saying?
There you go. What's a big deal, four houses on one street in a new subdivision?
Very good point. Very, very good point. That's a, you pulled that one out of your hat. That's a good one. So what else do you see? How else do you read this article? Well, is there anything in it that's anything at all interesting, or is it just the natural marketplace of they've just kept building and raising the prices and building the raising the prices, and finally, hey, they've gone too far. Is it on the builders and not on the buyers? Is it really a builder problem, not a buyer problem?
Well, when you have builders that continue to raise prices because the demand was there, not because your costs are truly higher, then eventually you're artificially inflating the price. And at some point, the consumers will come back and say, "You're too high, I can't buy." And they will have to adjust their prices. This just may be as simple as that, okay? I don't know the true economic behind on the builder side, but the first thing I got out of this was, wait a minute, four or five houses on one street, what is the big deal, okay? And then from there, the writer pulled these numbers from left and right, but it seems like everything is about the last two, three quarters. We haven't seen a larger picture of it at all. And at the same time, Frisco, Plano, Dallas area, these are hot booming markets with hundreds of thousands of people moving in on an annual basis. This may be a temporary situation. We haven't seen enough to be able to say this will sustain.
Well, let's say it doesn't sustain. It is definitely a change in market conditions. So how do you see that change affecting anything that you're doing out there at all, or is it just a non sequitur? It means nothing.
It means nothing to us whatsoever because we invest into Class B, Class C apartments. that's mostly working class to slightly white collar environment, and people need a place to stay. They need a roof over their head. Yes, maybe that a one bedroom apartment instead of a single individual, instead maybe a small family that's just newly married. The situation more or less is, okay, they're quoting large $1 million homes. That's not your typical environment. That's not your typical working class. Let's push that aside. Let's kind of look at just the working class. If it's working class, then what's the average income in the Dallas market? And in Frisco, in Plano, the average income medium for households are over $90,000 each. Okay? $90,000 in the old way of traditional rule of thumb calculation, $90,000 a year can buy them a $270,000 home. If the starter homes are at that price, they can still afford to buy those homes. And more new families are dual income nowadays. So that means their income can go even higher. They can buy even more homes. So if you were 95, let's just say we have 50% only instead of multiplied by two, we're saying somewhere around $140,000. $140,000 times three, that is what, $420,000 worth of a home they could afford.
Okay.
I don't know where this article is trying.
We'll come back to the article because there's more on exactly what you're talking about, the median price, the median sales price, and so on and forth. We'll cover that when we come back. Guys, 877-711-5211. If you want to call and ask Charles or myself a question, get on the phone now. We'll be right back with Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show.
Talk 1370.
Welcome back to Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show. With me here today is Charles Ho out of Dallas. We're discussing this article that came out about how the Dallas housing market on the top end is cratering. So, Charles, I flipped over to the next page and covered this other information that you had sort of shot down to. It says prices have shot up in the past 5 years. This is by Dallas. It's about Dallas, by the way. To $235,000 for a medium price home. Now, remember when we came out of the crash, right? When we came out of the crash in 2007, 8, 9, we had the crash, 2007, 8, median prices were $152,000. So this is 50% above, they're saying, what it was in 2007 peak, which was in line with the increases in places like San Francisco, Seattle, and so forth. As mortgage rates rise, buyers increase to look for less expensive homes. That's pushing builders further out to the fringes in search of low-cost land where they can try to build more homes priced at $300,000 or less. The median price for new homes in Dallas has dropped by some $3,000 this year compared with last year, according to Metro Study, which suggests builders are building at lower price points. That can be a risky strategy after the heat has already started to come out of the market. During the last downturn, it was precisely those ex-urban neighborhoods that got hit the earliest and the hardest by buyers migrating back to more desirable neighborhoods when prices fell. So you see what they're saying there is that you build all this stuff out there because it's cheap and people might buy it now. But if markets start to fall, that stuff craters because nobody really wants to live out there. They're only living out there because it's the only place they can afford. But if all of a sudden inner city or more desirable areas become open and those prices come down to more affordable pricing, people are going to move into those things and leave all this ex-urban neighborhoods to rot. Do you guys have ex-urban neighborhoods out there? I know in Houston we do. Houston is like a swamp that goes on forever, and we just keep building at the edges. And, you know, right now there's housing all the way from Galveston all the way past Conroe, all the way past Rosenberg. I mean, all the way out now, down Highway 59, I-10, miles and miles and miles, and all the way over to Beaumont on the other side. I mean, Houston is like five counties. So that means there's all kinds of this ex-urban neighborhood stuff. What about up there? Do they have that up there, or is it just Plano, and that's the end of the world? It stops.
No, Plano has further out. They can go from Plano to Frisco to Prosper to Salina to Gun Barrel. You can just keep going. But the thing is, there are people who choose to live out there. They choose the lifestyles. They choose the type
Charles,
of commute.
Are you sure, Charles? Are you sure? Or is it like they're saying that's all they can afford? You know, I live in a 16,000-square-foot home that would take my entire net worth to buy probably in California. Here in Houston, it was a year's worth of paycheck. I mean, I live out in ex-urban area. There is a difference, man. You can own a lot more home further out. So you can say I chose this area, but would I rather be a better location if I could for the same? I would. So the question is, are you sure that they're buying it because they want to be out there in the middle of nowhere? I mean, this is Texas. You're out in the prairie. Come on, be honest. Be honest now. Which one is it? If you say it's because they want to live out there, I'll take your word for it.
I cannot categorically say everybody's that way, but there's always both sides of the coin, right? There are people who choose to live out there, and then there are people who are forced to live out there. But keep in mind, there are still apartments with rent in the less than $1,000 a month in the so-called urban or near downtown areas. So people still have a choice. If they choose to live in apartments and keep their rents down, they can still do it. That's still doable. And I just want to go back real quick because I remember this is journalism 101. When you write stories, you write these keywords in there, and then you're supposed to trigger some type of a emotion and attached to the story so you keep on reading. And I think you mentioned houses dropped $3,000 this year of a $300,000 home. That's
1%. Yeah. 1%, yeah.
What's the big deal? I think their marketing budget is more than 1%.
Charles, I think it's a big deal to the builders and a big deal to the real estate agents. I don't know. You're right. To us, it means nothing at all. And, you know, it's just one of those things. So we'll take a short break. We'll be right back with Charles Ho and the Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show. If you call in 877-711-5211, we'll be right back.
Talk 1370.
Welcome back to Lifestyles Unlimited, the Real Estate Investor Radio Show. With me today is Charles Ho, multifamily mentor out of the Dallas market. Charles, we're going to change directions now. We're going to pick up on the topic you came prepared to talk about today. You presented an idea in your syllabus today that I thought was interesting, but I think we got to be careful about how to provide the insight into this. And that was, you're saying, we normally go out and buy an asset, then we figure out how to staff it. And in your case, you said that you've come to the conclusion you want to staff it and then buy it type of thing. Very interesting timing issue there. Secondly, it also has to do with how big your portfolio is. Does your portfolio have enough room to be able to sustain absorb some short-term payroll costs to be prepared that when the next deal comes along that you're closed? And by the way, is this something you're doing way in advance, or is it just right after you get into contract and you realize you're going somewhere? So it's an interesting conversation, to say the least. The value of the staff is utmost important. I can change the value of an apartment by changing the manager. That's a simple statement, but a very powerful statement. The people who run your business are your business and will determine your asset value. So I'm going to let you take it from there. I don't know how you wanted to propose this conversation, but I wanted to warn on those points. That could be a very scary situation about telling people to pick up payroll before they have income to cover it. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think the important part of it, more or less, is you need enough time to train the new staff to understand the company philosophies and values and systems like that ahead of time. And I guess as far as how far in advance, depending on your ability to absorb that payroll cost, we try to have the hiring started as soon that we found a deal that's suitable and we are going under contract. So basically, the day of under contract, we are acting very actively looking for that individual. And we want that individual to be on the payroll as soon as possible so that we can start training immediately so they understand the company philosophies and everything that goes along with it. And so that they can get a taste of going to other assets that we already own and understand the operation, so that's one way we do to standardize everything so that when they get to a new asset, they already know what they require. They don't know how to do everything according to the way we want it done and just start working immediately. So that's really the main idea behind that. No, we're not promoting or saying we need to hire somebody 2 years ahead and then while we're looking for something to buy. No. We want them to be on payroll as soon as we have an asset ready for them.
Okay, so let's take it one step further then. I've heard both sides of this story, so I'm going to hear your opinion. I know some people that say that hiring staff is finding the right person. In fact, I think that's Melissa's theory. You find the right person that you can work with, that is willing to learn and study and take your direction, and you can take, in the apartment industry, take those kinds of people and make them great employees. Robert Martinez believes that a little bit to be true. Also, I believe, he does believe that because he's brought most of his staff up from underneath, keeps his staff growing within. Yet other people are kind of, I think, more John Ridgway-ish, which is let's just go hire people in the industry that have already done it for years. It's, drop and plop into positions, and they should be able to do it. What's your opinion on that, Charles?
Our experience tells us that we do better based on our philosophy is that we train them from the ground up. You build a lot of relationship there, and you build a lot of loyalty. And I always say this in the past, if I can steal somebody from somebody else, then that person can be stolen from me just as well and just as easy.
Interesting point. It's a good point. It's kind of like a wife. Would you ever want to marry the girl you cheated on another man with, right? You know, she'll cheat with you, she'll cheat with somebody else. That's a good point. All right. So how do you find these people, and what do you look for?
We mail for a great team player, and this goes back to a book I read before, is that the person has to be humble, has some smarts, and at the same time has to be eager. I think the book mentioned hungry. I guess sometimes it gets misinterpreted. We have to have the eagerness to learn. And once you can find that combination.
I think we're hungry. We're hungry for some ads to pay for the bills to have the show on the radio, so we're going to have to take a break. We'll be right back with Charles Ho and the Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show.
Talk 1370.
Welcome back to Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show. Today, Charles Ho, multifamily mentor out of Dallas, is discussing hiring staff for his businesses as he realizes that they are the key determining factor of success in many cases. Charles, pick it back up. You said you like to pick people that are educated or at least intelligent, good learners, loyal. And then what do you do with them? How do you get them trained?
Well, we'll bring them in and understand their personality profile, and also is what we call a team player profile. Understand what best positions fits them based on their natural tendencies. And from there, we get through the onboard process and let them understand what the company values are, and making sure that it is a fit. One thing I've always said in the past, I can train somebody the skill sets all day long. There's never an issue, but I still haven't figured out how to properly train somebody, to be honest. And we have gone through several of those situations in the past, and now it is number one issue for us. If we can't trust the individual, they're no matter what I do, it's not going to work out. So that's how we get through the process and placing them on property, going through the procedures, and then let them see what that position really is about. And they tip their toe in it, do a little bit, and we assess that and make sure that it is something they are natural. And from there, we just keep going. And then usually we're thinking about a three-month period. We can get them to a level where they actually can become self-sustaining. When we say that is they actually can generate or do enough work to warrant the pay they're receiving.
So let's go back to the honesty thing for a second, because I like the statement, but I'd like to have a little more rubber to the road in how you ascertain in an individual up front. Do you put them through some honesty tests, throw some dollar bills on the table and leave them there, see if they pick them up or take them home with them? Or how do you ascertain someone's honest up front like that?
We haven't gotten that far yet, but what we do is we start just having conversations, building relationships. People who typically have an issue in that area are less vulnerable, willing to talk and to be open in the conversations, and they will get a little bit more evasive. And when that comes up, you know, they kind of throw some of the red flag, and then we kind of just have to dig a little bit deeper. If we have to dig really hard, that tells us we are onto something and this may not be a fit.
Gotcha. All right. So you pick these people up and you start bringing them in. You say it's about a four-month period before they can actually start to pay for themselves to be there as an employee. What do you do in the interim while you're working with people that are not self-supporting, not self-producing?
We see that as part of the training cost, and at the same time, we see that as part of the risk. If I have somebody who actually comes in and looks like they're doing a great job, but steals underneath, behind the book, then I'm actually better off having somebody who does not steal and take that money that lost up front, become part of the training. It actually works out better for us.
You know, just out of curiosity, and I ask this question with tongue in cheek, because, you know, as an educator, I hate to ask questions that lead to negative thought processes to people, because people are trying to get over this, but it's just too easy. It's set up there to take a shot at it, and that basically, well, what time is it here? I don't know if we have enough time to actually clear this, but I was going to just throw this thought out. Is theft the real high problem? I've not seen theft as a very high problem. Are you seeing theft as a high problem from employees, or is that something I've just been lucky on? I mean, I don't say I haven't ever had it. Don't get me wrong, but it just seems to be like the one thing I haven't had a major problem with.
Yeah, we have had that problem on three occasions so far in, 7 years? And we always review and go back, what did we do wrong? What caused this? And, of course, number one thing is when it is a single individual working in the office and no other individual in the office, that tends to start, and that's one. Another is is somebody who is not willing to be vulnerable, to be open to you, has tends to have that tendency.
All right, we're going to cut it off right there, Charles. We got to go to break. They're taking us out the back end. We'll be right back with the last segment of Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show.
Talk 1370.
Welcome back to Lifestyles Unlimited, the Real Estate Investor Radio Show. We'll be here today, Charles Hull, multifamily mentor out of the Dallas area. Charles, I know you've got like a boatload of designations behind your name, so I'm sure you've taken, you know, CAM, CAP, CIRO, the whole bit, whatever, like your encyclopedia. So let's go through the industries, basic position on what staffing should occur for each size of a property. Start with 50 unit, 100 unit, 150, 200. Tell us how you staff up a property. What do you see the turning points for different types of staffing combinations as you look at the size?
My experience in the ownership side was 85, 96, 146, 48 and 256 units each. And at 85, that's one person in the office and one maintenance on the outside. 96 is pretty much the same. And when we were doing that project, we started realizing, well, if we have a lot of make-ready and renovations, we can actually afford to start having a second maintenance individual to help on that process and reduce the cost on one-time contractors coming in to make ready. So that's when we started building up our staffing, the construction and maintenance side. And as we continue to have additional assets, we're adding in that fashion. But when we had 146, we inherited a manager who was on site already, who knew how everything worked, and had the same, was able to believe into the philosophies that we have and has a value system that matches with what we have. So that was a very good combination. And 146, one person in the office, typically considered, well, that's a little bit of a stretch. But for us, understanding her relationship with the tenant, the resident base, tells us it's perfect because we have over 85% renewal rate on that asset. And even though as we were pushing rents to the correct market position, our residents were still willing to pay because they knew that new owners coming in were taking care of them, were making things happen, making repairs. So no matter what the requirements or the requests are, as long as those are reasonable and that's something that we believe we should be doing, we try to meet their needs as well. And from there, we started testing. Can we truly operate 150 units with one person in the office? And we had another 148. We started with one, with another carrying a manager carrying a part-time leasing agent. And it started out great. Everything was good, but leasing agent had to leave and for personal reasons. So we ended up with just a manager. And the manager was able to hold down to that without much trouble. And that's where we started figuring out how to stretch that individual and at the same time provide enough supervision so that we can prevent theft and stuff like that that happens in that environment. And as of today, I can say we know how to run 150 units with one person in the office with two, one and a half, we call it, which is a lead maintenance and a assistant that's also serving as a porter on the outside from the maintenance side. So those are kind of where we are on that. And with that information now on the 256, we learned to staff that from a typical 3 or 2.5 down to 2, and building the people up to the point where they understand what their responsibilities are and their skill sets, so that they know how to properly manage 256 units with 2 people on the inside.
So you're looking at trying to figure out how to reduce the payroll below the standardized typical market situation of what's the industry standards, one body per 100 units on the office, one body per 100 units outside. When you get to 150 units, you add a part-time person on each of those, and when you get to 200 units, you set up a second person. That's the industry standards called the Rule 100s, what they look at per staff. So you're trying to work that down. Most I've ever had was 132 unit, which was a 64 and a 68 across from each other, run by one manager. She had no problem with it either, but again, she was a great manager. Properties were right across the street from each other. And we ran that with 2 maintenance guys, one on each shop, one in each location, and then her running. So good stuff. Trout, appreciate you coming and sharing your insight today, and look forward to having you back sometime in the future. Otherwise, have a wonderful holiday. Buy lots of real estate. And remember, it's not the money. It's the lifestyle. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you tomorrow.
For listening to the Lifestyles Unlimited Real Estate Investor Radio Show. Remember that this show is for entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as legal, investing, or tax advice. Results may vary. Always consult a professional before making any financial decisions. If you'd like to find out more about the mentoring available at Lifestyles Unlimited, please visit them online at lifestylesunlimited.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.